50 years ago this week, the United States Supreme Court heard final arguments in a case that would reshape America. A half century later, the nation still struggles to meet the goals of Brown versus Board of Education, and over the coming months, we'll be examining the legacy of this ruling. Today, the last of three reports from NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg on how the court finally reached its decision.
In April of 1954, after months of consultation with the other justices, Chief Justice Earl Warren was drafting an opinion in the Brown case. He worked initially by himself, writing by hand on a yellow legal pad. By the first week in May, the drafts, one for the four state cases, one for the District of Columbia case, were in final polished form and ready to be shown to the other justices. The speed of the process was now breathtaking. It was May 7th. Warren put a cover sheet on the opinions. The attached drafts, he wrote, are offered as a basis for discussion and were prepared on the theory that they should be short, readable by the lay public, non-rhetorical, unemotional, and above all, non-accusatory. So secret was the process that the Chief Justice hand-delivered the opinions to those justices who were at the courthouse, while his law clerk, Earl Pollack, delivered Justice Black's copy to him on the tennis court at Black's home and carried Sherman Mittens to him at his apartment. As for Justice Robert Jackson, whose vote still hung in the balance, Warren brought the draft to him at Doctor's Hospital, where Jackson was still recovering from a heart attack. Jackson's clerk, Barrett Prettyman, was there. He quickly excused himself, returning, when Warren had gone, to his boss's side.
The main thing I saw in his face was relief.
And finally, Warren made a fateful visit to the justice who had most consistently dissented, Kentucky's Justice Stanley Reed. One Reed law clerk claimed to have overheard the chief tell Reed, "You're all alone now, Stan." But John Fassett, the clerk who worked on the case with Reed, dismisses that story as fanciful. He says that Reed had long since indicated he would go along for the sake of the country. Many of the justices had changes they wanted to make in the opinion. Warren accepted some, rejected others. But to a remarkable extent, the final draft was the same as the one he had written in his own careful hand. On May 15th, 8 days after Warren circulated the opinions, the justices met for their Saturday conference and formally voted their approval. To prevent any leaks, they decided to announce the decision just 2 days later, Monday, May 17th. At the court on Monday, few knew it would be a momentous day. Some of the law clerks had even left the building for lunch. At Doctor's Hospital, Justice Jackson's physicians advised him not to go to the court. The justice, however, was determined to be there as a show of unanimity. And after walking around for a while to test his sea legs, he was on his way in a court car. The automobile drew up into the court's underground garage unnoticed. At noon, the court convened. The justices stepped from behind the crimson curtains. And after the reading of three routine opinions, the fateful moment had arrived. This was to be Earl Warren's first major opinion for the Supreme Court. Sitting erect and slightly forward in his chair, he began to read the decision as in this reenactment.
"These cases come to us from the states of Kansas, South Carolina, Virginia, and Delaware. They are premised on different facts and different
he
local conditions."
He got to the key point where he said, "We hold," except he inserted into the opinion, when he read it, the word "unanimously."
Barrett Prettyman.
And when he said the word unanimously, the entire courtroom went, there was an audible drawing of breath from the crowd, because that was the one thing that no one had expected, really.
Thurgood Marshall had been going to court regularly in anticipation of a ruling. And as soon as Warren began to read, the nation's leading black lawyer found himself locked in a stare with the man he had expected to dissent, Justice Stanley Reed. When the word "unanimously" came from Chief Justice Warren's mouth, Marshall nodded ever so slightly at Reed, and the justice nodded back. From the bench, Warren explained that although the historical evidence on the 14th Amendment was inconclusive, public education in modern America was now a right, with attendance mandatory, and that it was essential for individual success.
"We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal."
Marshall ran to the phones to call his compatriots at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund back in New York. His euphoria would be short-lived. The court put over for re-argument the question of how it would implement its decision to dismantle segregated schools. In April 1955, the Supreme Court heard 4 days more of argument on how the Brown decision should be implemented. Thurgood Marshall contended that schools should be integrated immediately, while the southern states said there should be no deadline at all. Afterwards, the justices met in conference. Actors reading the notes taken by the justices reenact here what transpired. Warren began by expressing his view that the issues were so complex and varied that they should be left to the various district judges in the affected areas. But, he said,
"We should say something that will help the district courts. We ought to give them guidance. It would be rather cruel to shift these back and let them flounder."
Justice Hugo Black from Alabama, who'd steadfastly opposed segregated schools, now seemed to get cold feet.
"It is futile to think that these cases can settle the question of segregation in the South. People are going to fight this. Not one federal judge in the South is in favor of this. I think I know them all. We should move gradually, like a glacier."
Kentucky's Justice Reed, the last holdout for segregation, now, however, seemed more optimistic than Black.
"I don't know the Deep South. I have a firm belief that there's a considerable group wanting to give this decision sympathetic consideration. When some schools are opened, it will have a further effect."
Justice Tom Clark, a Texan, revealed in his remarks just how unequal the schools had been.
"The administrative problem is great. We can't simply relocate between colored and white schools, putting 500 students in shacks and 500 in good schools."
And while whites might go to school with colored children, he said, they would never allow their children to study under colored teachers. Justice Minton advised that the opinion should not say too much.
"We should not make big talk in the opinion and little words in the decree. The main thing is to get to work in the area. Democracy should never reveal its own impotence."
Once again, Chief Justice Warren repaired to his study to put down on paper in his own hand a first draft. And once again, the end product matched the first draft to a remarkable degree. It was just 7 paragraphs long. It gave local school boards the primary authority for desegregation, but under the supervision of the federal courts. The courts were ordered to put public schools on a racially non-discriminatory basis with, quote, all deliberate speed. The phrase came from Justice Felix Frankfurter, who got it from an Oliver Wendell Holmes opinion, and Holmes, as it turned out, got the phrase from a poem. At the NAACP headquarters in New York, Marshall's secretary rushed to the dictionary to look up the definition of deliberate. She said, "I'm looking at Webster's and I'm looking at deliberate, and the first word of similarity is slow." The dictionary was right. There was massive resistance in the South. In some places, the public schools simply closed for years. White children went to private schools. Black children were left to fend for themselves. In other places, there were riots and harassment of black children. In some locations, so-called free choice plans simply meant that all schools were open, on paper, to black children, while there was an understanding that few black parents would dare send their children to white schools. Neither the executive nor legislative branches of the federal government did anything to actively encourage school desegregation, though President Eisenhower did send National Guard troops in to enforce a court order in Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1957. Thurgood Marshall had thought a victory in the Brown case would mean the battle was over, but it was not, and he was unprepared.
"The other side planned all the delaying tactics they could think of. And so they took the initiative, and we ended up blocking their blocking tactics. And by that time, we'd lost all of our initiative. And I think that's where we made a mistake."
15 years after Brown, of the original school districts involved in the case, the Kansas and Delaware schools were largely desegregated. But in Virginia, where Prince Edward County had closed its schools from 1959 to 64, only 24 white children attended schools with the county's 1,800 black students. And in Clarendon County, South Carolina, the picture was even bleaker. In 1969, the question of school desegregation finally came to a head in Mississippi. Under federal court order, the federal government had come up with a desegregation plan for the state. But the Nixon administration, in an attempt to court white Southerners, asked the appeals court to postpone implementation of the plan. The appeals court agreed to the delay, and the black parents appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Chief Justice Warren was now retired, but Justice Black was still very much present. Black had suffered more than any other member of the court as a result of his vote to end segregation. He was so thoroughly ostracized by his Alabama friends that he did not make any public visit to his home state for more than a decade. His son was run out of his law practice and forced to leave the state. The justice was even scorned by his alma mater, the University of Alabama, which refused to send him an invitation to his 50th reunion. Now, 15 years after Brown, Black's patience had run out.
I think there's no chance of getting the colored people into integrated schools unless we eliminate all deliberate speed. The issue can't be litigated every time the problem is presented. It's been made into a political football by Nixon, and others will do the same.
The rest of the court agreed. Within days, the court ordered Mississippi to implement the federal government plan immediately. 2 years later, in a case from Charlotte, North Carolina, the new Chief Justice appointed by President Nixon, Warren Burger, wrote the court's unanimous opinion upholding the use of massive busing to desegregate the city's schools. Charlotte marked the high watermark for school desegregation. 3 years later, in a case from Detroit, the court, by a 5-4 vote, invalidated a school desegregation plan that included busing to and from the suburbs. The dissenters said only a metropolitan-wide remedy would work, and Thurgood Marshall, now a Supreme Court justice, condemned the decision for, quote, making a mockery of Brown. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.